IsraelScene.com. This is Israel Scene, and I'm Steve.
And this is Yoram.
And today we have an incredibly special guest, Zvi Bisk. Just to give you a breakdown, a brief breakdown of what Zvi is about, he's a futurist and strategic thinking consultant who has devoted himself to developing new and different ways of thinking about the future. This is coming off his website, by the way. He has produced a series of lectures, seminars, workshops, and courses dedicated to cultivating futurist habits of thought for business, general, and Jewish audiences. He has published over 100 articles and essays in Hebrew and English. His book, Futurizing the Jews, published by Prager Press, incorporates many of the ideas he advances in his lectures and workshops. And his forthcoming book is The Optimistic Jew, A Positive View of Jewish Life in the 21st Century, by the Maxana Press, and it's coming out July 1st of 2007. His website is futurist-thinking.co.il, and welcome.
Thank you. Great introduction.
So what's a futurist?
Well, there's a lot of debate. Futurists are one of those, there's a group of people that don't even know how to define themselves. There are some futurists that claim they can predict the future. I'm not one of those. Because if I really believe I could predict the future, I'd be very, very rich. I wouldn't have to work for a living. So I'm not one of those futurists that believe you can predict the future. I'm one of those futurists that tries to analyze current trends and analyze the possibilities and potentialities within those current trends and what we can do with these trends and perhaps what we should do with these trends. In other words, I say, okay, these are the trends. Now, what do you want to happen? I think there are an infinite number of alternative futures that you can create. Futurism, for me, is not a scientific enterprise. It's a value-laden enterprise. It's what you want. Whereas some futurists say it's a scientific enterprise you can actually predict. And I say you can have any future you want, infinite number of futures, as long as they don't contradict two things. And these are the boundaries of the possibilities. One, the laws of physics. And the second thing is current global trends. You can't turn history back. In other words, the radical Greens in Europe who want to go back to pre-Charlemagne Europe and live in villages and teepees without soap and hot water.
The Luddites.
That's not going to happen. You know, I mean, when I get a toothache, I want to go to a dentist. If I go to a dentist, I'm giving sanction to the entire Industrial Revolution. I'm giving sanction to the metals industry. I'm giving sanction to the chemical industry. I'm giving sanction to the electrical industry, I'm giving sanctions to the pharmaceutical industry, I'm giving sanction to the entire Industrial Revolution. If you say, okay, I want to ameliorate the damage caused by the Industrial Revolution, that's fine, that's possible. And now we have the technology to do it. When one of the most aggravating things to me is we, within 10, 15 years, the West can be energy independent and cut its negative environmental impact in half, without lowering the standard of living and even having the standard of living constantly go up. So these are things that can be done. So it's a question of what should we do and what can we do given the new technologies and the new... What is fascinating to me about the new technology is its cultural and social implications, not the technology itself. I'm not a techno freak. I love it. It's great. But what possibilities does it give us? And that's what I deal with.
One of the statements that you made that I find most interesting and I think is most critical for us to delve into at this point is the idea of energy independence, which you cover in your energy project Blueprint for Action, which is on your website. Mm-hmm. I thought it's one of those things that's so obvious. You wonder, how is it that other people haven't thought of it? And how is it that people aren't actually doing it? And I'm wondering if you could give us a brief on your ideas for energy independence.
Well, first of all, it's a chapter in the book, too, The Optimistic Jew. And I call it the Jewish Energy Project. I also just had an article, I call it the Gentile version of this. It's called Energy Independence. It was published in the Futurist magazine. And I don't even swear by the very details that I write in the article. I think when you look at futurism, you have to think of it as a kind of business plan. What is a business plan do? A business plan is two things. It's, first of all, it's wishful thinking with figures, in which, you know, okay, I can build a logical, coherent model for something to do in the future. But it also gets you moving in a direction. Now, you know, if you're in business, that if you don't revisit your business plan every 6 months, you're like, you're out in the cold. You know? So I'm not going to swear by everything, every technical thing I say. But what I say is, all these things exist. We can achieve energy independence. The West can achieve energy. America can achieve. I think the lower 48 states can achieve energy independence within 20 years. I think NAFTA can achieve energy independence within, by 2015. I mean, if you consider Canada and Mexico. And it can be done by several ways. First of all, you've got technologies now that's called... There's thermal depolymerization and there's catalytic depolymerization. What they do is they take anything that's based on hydrocarbons or carbon-based, which is garbage, sewage, manure, tires, plastic, and turn it into synthetic diesel oil. And one of the waste products of that is gas, which they can use also. See? You can use the same kind of... There are similar technologies, I don't know the physics of them, which can turn coal into... methane gas, and synthetic diesel. Now, I've read that there's enough manure and garbage in the United States to gain energy independence just from that if you exploited 100% of it. We're never going to exploit 100% of it. So that's one thing you could do. Another thing that I didn't even mention in the article was if everybody turned to fluorescent lighting within the next 1 or 2 years, you could close hundreds of power plants around the country, you could say. And energy is fungible, you see. So if the coal industry is not selling coal to produce electricity, they'll find they're going to have to invest in money to produce methane gas or synthetic diesel or whatever it is. You've got what they call flex fuel engines, which work on a combination of 85% ethanol and 15% gasoline. If you made it a law. If you legislated that by 2008, every automobile sold in the OECD had to be a flex fuel engine, which means it can use either pure gasoline or 85% ethanol, over the course of 16 years, you could wipe out 85% of your consumption of gasoline.
So tell me, is it laziness, lack of will? What's the economics? I mean,
I think it's a combination of all. First of all, there are interests. Second of all, there's stupidity, which is still the biggest learning disability is stupidity.
You mentioned that in the book.
Yeah. And third, I think it's modern public service are very busy. They don't have time for reflection. They don't think. I mean, if you've ever been in the Knesset, and it's the same in, you go to the Congress or you go to the Parliament in England, it's the same thing. I mean, you'll see people, you know, going to the bathroom and still talking on their cell phone. I mean, they're doing two or three things at once. They don't read a book. They get briefed, you know, and they're running back and forth. And they have two or three parallel professions, public servants. They have to get elected, which is a full-time profession. If they're conscientious, a lot of them are, by the way. They have to do their job. They have to go to all these committees, you know, and they have to watch their back in their own party. You know, it's like a triple, that's a trifecta, you know. And it's not much different in the United States. But the basic fundamental thing, and this is one of my methodologies in futurism, is I say, what is knowledge? See, everybody says, you know, knowledge is something good. And I say, well, maybe it's not so good. Because where does all our knowledge come from? It comes from the past. Everything you know is past. You learned it, you were taught it, you experienced it, all past. That's what you know. And that's your filter for relating to the future. See? And I try to break holes in that filter. I try to break windows in that filter. Because we don't live in the past. We live in the future. You know, and people say, well, no, we don't. We live in the present. I say, what's the present? The minute you say the word present, it's past. Present is a fiction. It's like, you know, the point in when you learn mathematics, you know, from point A to point B, Well, there's no point A and point B. These are fictions. This is an invention in order to make our thinking a little more, you know, we can handle it a little better. But actually, what a human being is a creature that is constantly moving into his or her own future, carrying his or her past on his or her back. You know, and they're bent over like Quasimodo with the past. Now, if you're a Jew, boy, do you have a past. You know, and you're constantly looking at your past, and you constantly get slapped in the face by the future. Now, one of the interesting things about Zionism is that it's future-oriented. Herzl was a futurist. The Jewish state is a futurist scenario. Alt-Neuland is a futurist scenario. Ashkenaz is a futurist scenario. Ben-Gurion was a futurist. Jabotinsky was a futurist. Rav Berlin, Bar-Ilan, was a futurist. And one of the catastrophes of post-Sixth Day War, and I'm very ambivalent about the Sixth Day War because it's the reason I'm here. I wouldn't have been here. It changed my life. It changed a lot of Jews' lives, I think. Is we became past-oriented. You know, we have the settlement movement, which is past-oriented. Wherever Abraham laid his head is ours. Great. We have the kibbutz movement, which is past-oriented. About 2 years ago, I had opportunity to give a talk for the secretaries of various kibbutzim. There's about 200 or 300 secretaries in the room at the kibbutz movement. And I said, I'm about to say something that's probably going to offend you. Ironically, it didn't. He said, I knew when you were about to have your crisis. And I said, when? When you began building museums in the yard of the kibbutz celebrating the third aliyah. I said, when you celebrate the past, and this is your ideal, and you're not moving into the future, you're not reinventing yourselves constantly. Or as an acquaintance of mine, a former acquaintance of mine, I haven't seen him in years, Professor Tzvi Lanier, who did organizational consulting based on the language of the organization. And I asked him, Tzvi, what does that mean? This is 20 years ago he told me this. He's probably changed it a bit. He said, well, look, if Yitzchak Sadeh came back to life today, and went to a meeting of the general staff of the IDF. Now, Yitzhak Sadeh was both a kibbutznik and the founder of the Haganah, right? So I want to get your listeners who we're talking about here. He went to the general staff of the IDF meeting. He wouldn't understand a word. If he went to a Asifa Klali, the general meeting of a kibbutz, he'd understand every word. Okay. What does this mean? It means that the IDF, despite the fact that we've demystified it, and thank God we've demystified it because it's healthy for the IDF that we've demystified it also, is still a creative dynamic culture that's constantly recreating its own language. Even the slang of the kids, I mean, the kids, you know, my boy was in the army, comes back, he starts talking to me, I'm shaking my head, yeah, I don't know what the hell he's talking about. You know, every year or two they have a new slang, yeah. And you've got to come out with a new dictionary. Whereas the language of the kibbutz was still back there, you know. Now you see that in our political culture. You know, all the parties are still speaking the language of past ideologies. All our political ideologies have their roots in the 19th century. Now this is the problem of politics all over the world. And that's one of the reasons why all over the world the leadership is entrenched, as we say in the medieval French, you know. But with us it's a little more important. You know. Because although we are a constitutional republic, and even though we don't have a written constitution, we're a constitutional republic, constitutional republics are self-correcting mechanisms. I think the last 10, 15 years we've had the worst government we've had in the history of Zionism, but life in this country has improved greatly. Transportation, you know, Kfish Shesh, the railroads, you know, service at the interior ministry, service at the licenses, private services and banks, restaurants, cafes, the life in this country is really, it's a self-improving mechanism. And you see that all over the world. I mean, you see it in America. They don't have the greatest administration right now either, do they? You know, you see it all over the world. So the people say, so why do you need leadership? Well, because in this country, we still have Iran. We still have, you know, nuclear threat to our existence. And we have the Palestinian problem. We still need Israel more than any other country in the world needs great leadership. We need it more than America needs great leadership. You know, they'll be okay. Europe will be okay. Mm-hmm. You know, the modern society is a self-correcting mechanism. But we don't have that. You know, we don't have it because our entire political culture is still rooted in the past. We're not future-oriented. I'm a futurist that believes in developing a romanticism for the future. You know, the romantic movement romanticized the past. Mm-hmm. I want people to fall in love with the future. I want people to be nostalgic for the future, not for the past.
I'm really curious as to how that works, but what I've been wanting to ask listening to you is this emphasis on the future and a kind of a negation of the past in the Jewish context seems very out of place. I mean, we believe we have something to do with the past and we look to the past. How do you propose, and I assume you do propose, some kind of a balance between the past and the future? Because if we just completely ignore the past, I think we've lost something.
I teach history. I'm a historian. I love the past. I believe futurist methodology is historical methodology applied to the future. So what is my attitude, my ideological position regarding the past? Number one, we should learn it. We should understand it. And I don't mean only learn the history of our culture and our nation, but learn the history of our professions. How many doctors know the history of medicine? How many engineers know the history of technology? How many teachers know the history of education? And that's why you have a kind of arrogance of the professional classes. They're the alpha and the omega. They don't realize they're just another chain. They're another link in the chain that's going on ad infinitum. I think you should learn the past. I think you have to respect the past. You have to draw lessons from the past. You celebrate the past. All our holidays are celebrations of the past. Mm-hmm. You do not idolatrize the past. You do not turn it into an idolatry. You don't sacrifice the future in order to realize the past. You use the past as an inspiration to create a better future. The past is a resource. It's a raw material. You filter out the slag. You filter out the crap. You filter out the things that are unacceptable to a modern, sophisticated, progressive human being. And you take the good stuff. You don't tell me that you'd have to take the entire tradition, whole, excuse the expression, hog. You should excuse the expression, as Jackie Mason might say. You know, or you're not a Jew. I'm sorry. To be a Jew is to be critical. To be a Jew is to be volitional. I once heard a very good midrash, very interesting midrash. Why did Abraham receive the Brit and not Noah? Sorry, very interesting question. Okay, what's the answer? And the rabbis talk about it in the Talmud. I can't quote it, the Baba Booba, the Baba this. I don't know, but it's there, believe me. God comes to Noah, says, Noah,
yes.
I'm going to exterminate the entire human race except for your family. And what does Noah do? He goes and builds a boat. He says, okay, give me the hammer and nails. I'm getting busy. Comes to Abraham and says, Abraham, I'm going to destroy Sodom and Gomorrah, which really have it coming. And Abraham argues with God. And because in the end they don't find 10 good men, and because in the end Sodom and Gomorrah are destroyed, we forget that Abraham wins the argument with God. God says, oh, leave me alone already, okay. God didn't create human beings to be slaves. God created human beings to be free human beings. I believe in using the past. The midrash, or barmara, whatever it's called, of Bat Kol. Do you know the story? There's a group of rabbis and they're arguing. And there is a minority opinion of one guy and the majority opinion of all the rest. And the one guy says, and what if the voice of God comes down now and says that I am right? And sure enough, the voice of God comes down and says, Eliezer is right. If it's Eliezer, might be mixed up with the voices. That doesn't make any difference. And the leader of the majority says, looks up at heaven and says, since Ma'amad Har Sinai, since we received the Ten Commandments at Mount Sinai, we have no need of voices from heaven. And the story goes on to say, and God laughs and says, and the heavens shake from his laughter. He says, my children have outdone me. What does this mean? Once we've got the general rules, Ten Commandments, which are pretty universal, not just us. So we're volitional. We pick and choose. If we don't pick and choose, we're slaves. We cannot be slaves to the past. We are free, volitional, autonomous human beings. And if you believe in God, you know, it makes it, or if you believe in the idea of God, whatever, but if you believe, then, yeah, you're allowed to argue. You're supposed to argue. He wants you to argue. I once had this discussion with a Haredi guy, although kind of a modern Haredi guy. And I said, you know, if I had any literary talent, I would write a play called The Appeal. And what's the story of the snake puts in an appeal. He wants his legs back. So why is this? He says, because if God created human beings, he created the world in order to give a Torah, according to the tradition, right? Well, to give a Torah, it only makes sense if you have volitional human beings that know something. So that means he wanted human beings to eat from Etz Hadat. So he says, why is he being punished? It's a contradiction here, philosophical contradiction. I even had, you know, the judge would be Moses who would stutter, and I had the whole thing of the blah, 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 you know, and the defending God would be Satan, it would have been great if I could write.
Good,
you know,
theater.
It would have been terrific. I can't write.
You could do it on YouTube.
And I can't do fiction. I only do nonfiction. Anyway, so Tzvi, maybe he wanted them to rebel by themselves and not have the snake seduce them into rebelling. I said, whoa. Now that's a thought.
That's good.
You know, I've always liked the question of why is it that man is of a higher nature than the angel? And the answer was that the angel has no choice but to be good, and man has a choice. So that when man makes the choice to be good, to be conscious, to be, you know, thoughtful of his fellow man and his fellow creature, then he really has achieved something where the angel has no choice. He's stuck. He has to be perfect.
Yeah.
Right.
I often say that when God created the universe, he had a division of labor. Perfection was his job. Our job is to make things just a little bit better. Tikkun olam. Just to repair it a little bit. So, and every utopian philosophy that tries to make things perfect ends up in catastrophe. Ends up in gulags, in guillotines, and all this other stuff.
So with that note, today, Israel, with the younger generation, when I say teens, 20s, some of them see themselves as Israeli and don't really identify at all with being Jewish. So therefore, there's a sense of rejecting a past. So if it's important to be in the future, but to honor, to respect the past, to take from it the inspiration to continue. What's happening now currently in Israel in terms of the future generations? I mean, first of all, what is an Israeli and what is it to be a Jew?
Well, an Israeli is a citizenship. I mean, you know, people tell me, well, you know, people say, well, we're better Jews than the diaspora because we speak Hebrew every day. I said, so does the Druze, so did my Druze captain in the army. I mean, so did the Bedouin guy that I worked with. Better Hebrew than the people. What does that mean? You know, I try not to get into that argument. I am infatuated with the concept of Ken Yirbu, let there be many, you know. And for me, Judaism is a peoplehood. It's a commonwealth. I talk in my book about Jewish citizenship and a post-Enlightenment view of identity, which means live and let live. I mean, what is really amazing about the founding fathers of the United States, the Federalists? Hamilton, in one of the Federalist Papers, said, don't ask me what my intentions are. You know, he would not like Immanuel Kant. You know, they built, America built a system that recognized that there are good people and bad people, and that every person is both good and bad, and that the system has to work and be good no matter what, okay? Whereas the French had a revolution where they wanted perfection, and they ended up slaughtering 30,000, 40,000 other people with the guillotine.
Mm-hmm.
You know, You want to be ultra-Orthodox? Fine. You want to be secular? Fine. I think the problem in Israel is, and here the religious have shot themselves in the foot. They have made, if they say Jewish identity is being religious, and you can't be religious, then you've made Jewish identity per se unattractive. Hello? You know?
Yes.
You won.
Boker Tov Eliyahu, you win. Okay.
Okay.
You say, I'm not a real Jew. Okay. I'm not a real Jew. You win. You know, it's in a way, it's almost like what the settlers did when they said there's no difference between a settlement in the West Bank and Tel Aviv. And they thought they were going to convince people that's going to make the settlement kosher. All they did was make Tel Aviv unkosher. For a lot of public opinion. They convinced people. You know, what are you talking about? People don't judge their values in light of the past. They judge the past in light of their values. You know, now, of course, we're talking about the West. We're not talking about the Muslim world. We're not talking about large segments of the third world. Okay, well, that's the global conflict, in which in microcosm, like usual, the Jews have within themselves, too. You know, the Jews are the microcosmos of the cosmos, you know. But this is a problem. Look, if I was in the United States, I would be associated with the Society for Humanistic Judaism, which is a totally atheistic, I don't believe in a supernatural God. I grew up in the conservative movement. I was bar mitzvahed in a conservative shul in the United States. It was convenient. It was nice. I like the chazanut. Love it. You know, I had a bar mitzvah where I didn't understand one word that I was saying, but it was wonderful. You know. And if I understood it, I probably wouldn't have agreed with it. You know. So, but I believe there can be a secular. I believe that any modern society must have a secular framework. You can be religious within a secular framework. You cannot be secular within a religious framework. It is not symmetrical.
That's part of the Islamic challenge.
They've never had a Renaissance. They've never had an Enlightenment. Look, the European tradition is totally different. The European tradition, because of its geography, probably, all through the Middle Ages, there was a conflict between the secular parties and the church. People don't know that the whole tradition of, the whole history of separation of church and state was fought by the church, not by the state. The Catholic Church did not want the local barons and lords to appoint priests and bishops.
Right.
Not separation of religion and state, but separation of church and state. Well, Islam has nothing like that. One of the reasons it doesn't have anything like that is it's a congregational religion like us. It doesn't have a central power. There is no real central power in it, whereas the church did. So Europe had special development. But you're right, there's been no secular Islam. Now in America, which is really interesting, you have organizations of secular Muslims.
That is an interesting beginning.
It's an interesting phenomenon. Now, when I look at this, I say, now everybody talks about how religion affected America. People don't talk about how America affected religion. How America took Calvinism, which was predestination, and in the Second Great Awakening said no. Second Great Awakening was from 1800 to 1830, and this is parallel to the democratization, to the Jacksonian period. And there was a guy named Finney who stood Calvinism on his head. Second Great Awakening was the second great evangelical movement in the United States, in America. Then it was the United States. First one happened in the middle of the 18th century, which created Columbia and Princeton and a few other universities, you know. And this guy Finney said, no, we can save ourselves. You can be saved. You can make a choice. It's not chosen. He stood Calvin on his head. Okay, now, this is interesting. Because the original Puritans were like the Jews. They believed that a whole nation can be have a brit with God,
Covenant
with God, not only individuals. So this standing Calvin on his head and saying, no, you can save yourself. I'm saved. I have a personal relationship. You know, and you look at all the 700 clubs coming forward. I'm saved. I accept you. I've changed. Calvin didn't believe that. Okay, but then if a whole nation can be in covenant with God and you can save yourselves, well, then you can save society, you see. And that's where all the reform movement comes from in the United States, the abolition movement and all these other reform movements which then sort of morphed into the progressive movement later in the century. And that's one of the reasons why America is so different than Europe in terms of religion. You know, I mean, they look at things so differently. Okay, so America, how did that happen? Because America was always optimistic. Why? Because you could get up and leave and go into the frontier and change your life, where in Europe you couldn't. So, look what happened to Judaism in America. And hopefully America can have the same effect on Islam. See, I believe that what happened in Boston 2 years ago with this pedophile thing with the priests,
mm-hmm.
I think 100 years from now, church historians will look at it as being as significant as the Council of Trent. Why? And it's interesting it happened in Boston, because the last time a authoritarian, non-transparent force did something in Boston, they threw tea in the harbor. Mm-hmm. So these Catholics are New Englanders.
They definitely
are. By the way, the Rabbi Soloveitchik, the Bostoner, that Litvak, there's something about New England, there's something about up there, boy, I'll tell you, you know.
Yes.
And what happened here? The lay people had a revolt, and they dictated to the Pope. And even though there's a mutual agreed, you know, lie here going on that it didn't really happen, really happened. And that changed the history of the Catholic Church forever, in my opinion. So America, the experience of America changes. And I think this is one of the disconnects between American Jewry, North American Jewry, and Israel. You know, Israel comes from Pinsk and Minsk and wherever it comes from, and American Jewry comes from America. And it's a live and let live activity.
That's why I thought it was so crucial to have American Jews come live here, because I think just the being here, there's an influence that is, inspiring, quite frankly.
Yeah, but it depends on which American Jews come here, because a lot of the atrocities that have happened are a certain group of American Jews. You know. So I think American Jewry, an American Jewish attitude. Now, as more and more Israelis travel around the world and become more cosmopolitan, and they are, and also I'm anti-intuitive and against the accepted wisdom, I think that the Israeli diaspora is going to play a very important part here.
You notice that you write about that in your book.
Yeah, I think those are because they understand both sides.
But they tend to in the States to separate themselves out of from the Jewish community for the most part. I don't know if that's
because
changing.
We separate them out. We call them Yoredim. So their very existence there is sort of opposed to the American Jewish myth about Israel being good and perfect and wonderful, and you know, so they're kind of treif on both sides of the thing, and it's very convenient for them too. I mean, you know,
it's wonderful.
You know, and they have their own culture. You know, how do I know Zionism succeeded? Israelis in America are still Israeli.
That's right. And the American Jews don't remind them all the time of that.
You know, they've created a separate culture. It's really interesting, yes. You see. But they also send their kids to Israel in these summer programs at a much higher percentage.
Yes.
Than the general American Jewish community. So there is something there that can be worked with. It doesn't mean it's automatic. It means we have to identify the potential and work with it. You know, you just can't turn your back on something. Like intermarriage. Oh, intermarriage is bad for the Jewish people. Well, it's either bad or good. I don't know. Why don't we create an organization, I write about it in my book, called Ruth. There's Ruth. There's God calling. The non-Jewish spouse, by definition, is moving closer to Judaism when they marry a Jew. And we're turning our backs on them. The other thing is, if we make identification with the Jewish people purely religious, and both spouses are agnostic or atheist, what? The shiksa is going to be more kosher than the Jew. I mean, you know, or you know, it's mm-hmm. a crazy situation we've created here, rather than seeing it as a wonderful potential. We've always had intermarriage. I mean, David comes from an intermarriage. My God, our greatest hero in Jewish life is a product of an intermarriage. Hello.
And the Mashiach comes in.
And now, apropos what you're thinking about the past, where does this attitude come from? We're still in the ghetto at some place. We still have walls around us. We're still closing ourselves. No, let's be open. Welcome. Come on in.
Well, this new Israel that you're mentioning certainly is precipitating that come in, welcome, just by the mere fact that we're moving out. Israelis are not entrenched any longer because of the economy and the technology. We're moving out, and we're also feeling freer and more comfortable to be here without feeling the siege.
Yes. We'll still be sieged.
Well, that's another...
Defense-wise.
Right.
And that's another problem, too.
Right.
I mean... A lot, you know, 99% of our public energy is still dealing with things that the rest of the world doesn't deal with. you know, you see the front page of a Finnish newspaper, it'll be where they're going to lay the new sewage line or something. I mean, you know, give me an example of what I'm talking about. About 2 or 3 years ago, on the Orthodox Christmas, 7 prime ministers and presidents of Eastern Orthodox countries came to Israel, including Putin.
Really?
You don't even remember it.
No. Yeah.
It was on the 7th page of Maariv. I'll never forget it. 7 prime ministers. Now, including Putin. I mean, you know, there was a prime minister of Bulgaria, the prime minister of this, the president of that. You know, I mean, like, it's like. So I look at the front page. Okay, it shouldn't be on the front page. This is more important. Look on the second page. Okay, they're right here. Look on the third page. Yep, yep. It's on the 7th page. Now, no country in the world, even America, New York Times, would have been front page news.
Absolutely.
You don't even remember it happened.
Nope.
It was in the middle of the Intifada or something, you know.